Greetings, listeners, and welcome back to another super duper bonus episode of Oh My Word. And we have, this is a bonuser bonus episode because we have a really, really awesome guest with us today. His name is Michael Levin. Michael Levin is a national best-selling author of just all the books, so many of them. And he's also a really preeminent ghostwriter. So really interesting things that we could speak with him about. And there's actually a lot more to the bio, but I just condensed it because I don't want to take up the entire podcast just talking about his bio, which we can. But you can go look him up afterwards and you'll just see it. There's just so much to say. So now that I've buttered him up, Michael, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Esther Leia. So nice to be here. And you can keep reading my bio. I got nothing against that.
So. Which is also carefully you can see the writing skill just in the bio because there's just so much. And he also had to condense it. The editor said, we need less words. And he said, I'll try. So let's start from the beginning. How did you get into writing? Like, how did you even become this national best-selling author?
Well, it helps to be fabulous. But the, when I was a kid, my parents were very big on reading to my sisters and me. And I knew I wanted to be a writer from the time my dad read me either Ask Mr. Bear or Winnie the Pooh. I don't remember because it's a long time ago. It's one of those two books. And that was really all I've ever wanted to do professionally. And, you know, if you'd asked me in college, what are you doing? I'd say I'm pre-novelist. Huh. And I was fortunate enough to write a book about Judaism while I was still in law school and then do three novels right off the bat with Simon & Schuster. And, you know, I was off and running. So, I was studying for the bar in the summer of 1985, which is a long time ago. And I would get up, 2 hours before the bar class and drag myself out of bed and say to myself, I don't feel very funny, but it didn't matter. It doesn't matter what time of day it is. You know, I still wrote funny. I was writing a novel about law school and Simon & Schuster bought it and, and I was off and running, which was really good because I was fired from both of my law jobs and I really couldn't get a third one. So the timing was very good because otherwise I would have literally been a starving writer. There are no starving attorneys, but there are starving writers and I didn't. There are no starving publishers. When did the writers decide we're going to starve? It's okay. I wasn't there for that vote. I would have voted against it. But anyway, so that's how it happened.
Me too. Well, I don't know if there's a quick answer to this, but why would you go to law school if you knew that you wanted to be a writer or you were going to try to do
it? It's a fair question. I didn't know how writers made money. And I couldn't figure that out. So I thought, well, lawyers write, judges write. I could still use my writing skills in my career and pay for my life.
Right.
But I really went to law school as a holding pattern because if you're in law school for 3 years, nobody asks you, what are you doing with your life? Whereas if you're sitting there trying to type something, then everybody's like, what are you doing with your life? I'm trying to be a writer. Oh, you mean you're a loser? No.
That's a very good point. Except, I don't know, did you figure out how to really make money off of writing? I think everyone, that is the elusive thing that everyone's searching for because the hustle just goes on.
Yeah, I really did. And I was very fortunate. I met a man who's been my mentor. I met him in February 94. So, he's been in my life now for 26 years and he's like a father to me. He was a very successful restaurateur and he mentored people. He said, I've worked with a lot of you creative people. You cannot do your best work if you don't know how you're going to put food on the table or pay your rent. Right. And he sat me down in a donut shop and took out a single sheet of paper and he said, you're going to open up writing classes, private writing classes. And we're going to figure out how much a month you need to live on. And then we're going to figure out how much, that way we can figure out how much you're going to charge for your classes. And you're going to spend 20 hours a week promoting, doing, and planning, doing, and, preparing for the next class, grading homework, whatever, for these adult writing classes. And that way you'll have 20 hours left, for your own work. And here we are 26 years later, that business that he showed me how to start in the Dunkin' Donuts became a ghostwriting business. I went from teaching classes to coaching to ghostwriting. And then I ended up with a huge team and we were doing more than 100 books a year. I sold that business. I started another ghostwriting business 6 months later. And, so the key to making money as a writer is not counting on, sales from the project you're writing to pay for your bills. It's create a stream of income that is independent from your writing so that you have the time and the space and the freedom to do your best work. And that's what I've done. And that's what I've been doing you know, in the 26 years since I met Bob. So that was how I learned to monetize this. And this whole thing about being a starving writer, to me, it's stupid. Why should you, you know, everybody else, yeah. your plumber comes over, he's compensated well, he doesn't have any, you know, deserve level issues, but why do creative people? So, you know, we have to get over ourselves and recognize that we're entitled to be compensated for the skills that we are developing as writers and for the entertainment and education we provide, because those are the two things that, what do writers do for people? They entertain and they educate.
Right.
Those are valuable skills. Entertainers are paid a lot of money. Educators, you know, at a higher level, at the grad school level and law schools or business schools, they're paid a lot of money. So why shouldn't we? So that's my case for, get the paper.
That is very good. I hope everyone is taking notes on that point. But speaking about that, people getting compensated, which we sort of mentioned, we talk about this. Have you ever had, or what do you say when someone comes over to you and they say something like, oh, you're a writer, can I read one of your books? Or like, send me a free copy. What do you say to that?
Yeah, they say, hey, you know, I'm your friend. Can I get a copy? I'm like, if you're really my friend, why don't you buy a copy? And, the other thing is that sometimes people used to say this to me. They say, hey, I took your book out of the library. I'm like, what do you want me to do? Thank you?
Right.
I don't. It's not like a registry. It's not like ASCAP where you get paid every time the song is played. If you really want to do me a favor, steal my book from the library. That way the library has to buy another copy.
Oh, I don't know if librarians would agree with that. We're going to have to keep you separate for the ones that we've had in the program so far.
I'm really not here for the library. I'll tell you my librarian joke. This guy goes in the library, says to the librarian, I want a cheeseburger, fries, and a Coke. And the librarian says, sir, this is a library. He says, oh, I'm so sorry. I want a cheeseburger, fries, and a Coke.
Terrible.
That's the librarian. Okay. But I'm really not here to make them a living. I'm here to make the writers a living. The librarians, it's a union job. They work, they work 2 hours a week. What do you want?
I'm sure this is very hard. There's enough hard work.
Yeah, I'm sure there are.
Whatever. More important, I think, I don't know, I have a theory that a lot of people think, first of all, a lot of people just don't realize how much time has to be put into a book, even, you know, whether or not you're a person who it takes you many years or whether or not you're someone who can write very quickly, there's still a time process that you can't beat the time process as far as editing goes, as far as actually getting the word down. And I just think that because everyone learns how to put together a sentence in, you know, first, second, third grade, they're like, oh, writing. And writing a book is not putting together a sentence is second, third. There is a skill set there. There's a reason why people are professionals with these things. I don't know if that's accurate or not.
No,
I decided.
It is. I mean, the thing is that the foundation of a good book is a good sentence. So if you can write a good sentence, you're on your way. And then it's just a question of learning construction and learning. You know, I mean, I taught writing at UCLA for, 11 years. Then I came back most recently and taught there. I taught at New York University. I've taught writing literally all over the country and all over the world. And what it really comes down to is you cannot teach people to be creative, but you can teach structure.
Right.
And there is book structure. There is paragraph, chapter structure. You know, how do you structure a book? What goes where? These are skills that can be taught and learned. And then a creative person, an able writer, can take those skills and use them as a channel through which their creativity can flow. And then they'll be very successful. But you got to know structure. And then you can say, oh, I don't like this structure. I'm going to make a new structure. Well, great. That's what all the greats do. But the thing is that they know on a foundational level, they know what the structure is the same way a composer knows music theory and the basics of chord structure, and then is able to create. So if as a writer you know structure, you're going to be fine. And that's what I've always taught. And that's what I continue to teach.
Right. Oh, actually, this is a side thing, but I remember you once had this whole thing about the way they say kill your darlings. And I think you reject that, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the stupidest things ever. Up there with, hockey. This is something that's attributed to Hemingway, and anything attributed to Hemingway is ridiculous because he was drunk half the time, so he even knows he doesn't know what he said. But there's this idea that you should go through your work and then take out the things that are the best and cross them out and get rid of them. And my attitude is that if you have half a brain and you can recognize something that you wrote that's really special, then, you know, made you, you know, put, I don't know if I can say this in front of you, but I used to tell my classes, put the writer's chastity belt around that sentence.
Right.
So no one can mess with it. And never, ever, ever, I mean, if it's that good, then honor it. You know, this whole thing about kill your darlings. Where do you think you're going to get more darlings from if you kill your darlings? Your subconscious is going to be like, I gave her these great sentences and she threw them out. Why should I give her any more? Let them go to somebody else. So, you know, I'm not a fan of that at all.
That is a very good point, because whenever I've seen that, I've been so confused about it. So I'm glad that it's not just me.
No, glad we had this little talk.
Yeah, exactly. So now you're writing your own stuff, and it seems you're doing pretty well over there. So how do you go now to transition from writing your own stuff to ghostwriting, which is, on the one end, now you're writing somebody else's stories, so you're not writing your own stuff anymore. So how do you do that? Like, how do you change like that?
The first book I ghostwrote was of a cousin who was one of Schindler's Jews, who was in the camps from something like age 14 to age 19.
Well,
and then he was in the displaced persons camps and came to America with nothing, became very successful. And he was, in fact, one of the three founders of the U.S. Holocaust Museum, the three biggest donors, and he and his two partners. And he's giving this bar mitzvah for his son. This is around his grandson, forgive me, his grandson, around 1988 or so. And it's this massive party. And then he gets up there and he's telling the story of, you know, he was in the camps and he never imagined that he would end up, you know, one day successful and having children, let alone grandchildren. And the room is in tears.
Wow.
I mean, everybody, the waiters are in tears, you know,
right.
The mashgiach is, everybody's crying, except for the bar mitzvah kid and his buddies, because, you know, they're 13 and everything's a goof at that age. So he comes back and he sits down and he knows that I write books, and we just sort of looked at each other, and I can remember the look. I don't even think we exchanged. We probably said, we have to do this.
Right.
And we ended up, it took 4 years because it was so hard for him to deal with the memories.
Wow.
But we would, you know, we would sit, we met mostly, he was in New Jersey, we'd sit in the lobby of the New York Hilton Hotel. And at the time they had a piano bar. So, and during the day the piano's covered up. So we would spread all these papers about, you know, all the different camps he was in. And people are passing, you know, if only they knew what we were.
Right.
And, you know, and the book came out and it was very successful. And, you know, it just sort of got me into the idea that, hey, you know, something, I can write in other people's voices. And then in the meantime, the business where I mentioned earlier, which was initially offering writing classes, and then that turned into people saying, can you consult with me on that, my book? And that turned into people saying, can you just write it for me? So,
oh, wow.
And then before long, I was selling more ghostwriting than I could do myself. So I started to hire other writers and I had a team, and then I had to bring in management people and so on and so forth. So,
right. So
that's the story.
Is that something that it's just, I guess, either personality fit, or was there actually some sort of, you know, sit down that you had to have with yourself to say, this is, I can't write in my voice, I have to write in his voice? Or is that something that you're just kind of able to do, like, hey, this works. Like, when I'm writing anyways, I have to write a character's voice, so this is my character that I'm writing in.
Yeah, that's it. I've never thought of it that way, but that's exactly what it is. You're writing in the voice of a character as if you were, you know, I mean, when I'm writing fiction, I'm not writing about a person. I'm being that person for the time it takes to write the line of dialogue about it. Then I'm being the other person. I'm being the third person. And you know, I was working on a project this morning. I mean, this morning I dictate almost everything today. I don't type out much.
Right.
So I was bouncing back, you know, inside the heads of the three characters, and they each have their own voice and their own idiosyncrasies. And that's exactly right. I've never thought about it that way. That's really, that's perfect. When you're ghostwriting, you are writing as if you were the character that is your client, and not your client. You're not saying your client's a character. You're saying,
right.
You know, this is, I'm trying to capture this person's this person's voice, COVID. This person's voice and this person's attitude and mode of expression and syntax. So it's mimicry. The same way that
right.
You're getting into the voice in the head of the character you're writing about in fiction. So
right.
that's And it's no big deal. I mean, once you get the hang of it, it's fun and it's very lucrative. I recommend it.
Right. Well, I guess, is there a benefit that now, because you're exploring stories that you wouldn't have looked at until now? So is this now opening different worlds for you, even though it's not, I mean, it's not fiction you're publishing under your name, but it's still, it's almost like a research project for you?
Well, yeah, I mean, I call it the greatest grad school in the history of the universe. Because, I mean, I've had over 750 clients in 30 years.
Wow.
And all of them are people at the highest levels of their fields, whether it's sports or technology or business or the arts or medicine or dentistry or finance. And they're basically paying me, and they're paying me well, to understand how they think and to teach me what they know. So, I mean, I did a book for a billionaire in Los Angeles. I've had a bunch of billionaire clients, and he loved, he's a real estate guy, but he also loves Chinese porcelain.
Huh.
And he has one of the foremost collections of 17th century Chinese porcelain, 17th, 16th century, in the world. And
Wow. What
was fascinating was we did a book that espoused his own theory of dating this particular porcelain, which is white Chinese porcelain from a town called Dehua in a certain era. And by the end, we sat down in his home and we held each of the pieces, and he had several hundred pieces that were going to be in the book. And together we debated, you know, what quarter of the 17th century a given piece was from.
Wow.
You know, where do you get that experience writing your own stuff? So
that's
just an example. Or go, you know, Dave Winfield's Baseball Hall of Famer. I know you're a big sports fan and a Yankees fan. And Dave and I have gone to Gabe. I did a book with Dave about 10 years ago, and we've stayed friends. We did another project. I go to baseball games with Dave Winfield. I go to Dallas Cowboy games with Chad Hennings, who won three rings with the Cowboys.
Right.
You know, I got to go to the 50th anniversary party of the Dallas Cowboys, and they were all there. Roger Staubach and Garrison, and all, you know, Hollywood Henderson, all these guys, I got to meet them all.
Wow.
You know, where does that happen when you're just, you know, you're doing your own stuff is great.
Right.
And I just want to suggest that there's a level of life experience and connection and meeting people and depth that happens when you get into the intimate relationship of writing a book for somebody else. So.
Right. Well, are you allowed to any book? Because sometimes your name does appear on some of these books that you've worked with individuals on. But if your name doesn't appear on it, are you allowed to? Is there some sort of contractual of how much? Talking about saying, I worked on that book. Or are you not allowed to do that? Or
well, it depends.
Okay.
I mean, the Bible. I worked on it.
If
they published the Bible today, if the Ten Commandments came out today, you know how they'd begin?
Yeah.
I am the Lord thy God, and my pronouns are he and him. Anyway. I wasn't involved with the Bible. But yeah, I was sorry if that's not pleasing to some of your listeners, but I don't care. The serious point is that certain books are bound by confidentiality agreements, and they don't want anybody to know that I was involved.
Right.
And then others, they could care less, and they've given me endorsements that are on my website, and still others, my name is on the book. So, you know, it's known that I did a book on football with the legendary Pat Summerall.
Yeah, I have that book. Yeah.
What's that? Yeah.
I
was working
book.
On when you were in the office. And
yeah.
Zig Ziglar, I edited his last book, and you know, a whole lot of brand name famous people. And I have to say that it's kind of fun when you look at your phone and it's some legend, you know, in some field calling in. And, you know, it's a kick. I mean, I won't lie. It's very, very enjoyable. It's really fun when you have relationships with people who are, because the thing is that the same way you pay money to go to a game to watch people play, or you go to pay money to go to a show or ballet to see, you know, here, if you know, you'd pay money to see these people think, but they're paying me to watch them think. So that's the beauty of ghostwriting.
That's a very good point. Yeah. I actually want to skip ahead. Usually I only ask this at the end, but I'm going to ask it now because I have a feeling that with you, it's not going to be a short one. Like, it's not going to be a short answer that can't be explored further. What are certain things either about the publishing industry or about writers that I love it when they do X, or they really get it right when they do X? What's something that you could fill in the blank with that?
when they tell me a story I don't know. You know, I mean, there's a lot of downtime. We're talking toward the end of the shutdown of the pandemic. So there's been a lot of downtime, and I've had a chance to do a lot more reading.
Right.
I've been, very fortunate to be very, very busy all through this. I'm working my usual 10, 11-hour days, and I love it. But at the same time, I just finished a book on the Crusades. I knew nothing about the Crusades. Oh, and I sit there, and I'm in awe, because most of the books we do are short. They're based on interviews with the author. And this is somebody who spent, he spent his whole academic career studying the Crusades, and he boils it down to 700 incredibly readable pages. And, somebody else wrote a new biography of Truman. So if you could tell me, that, I know about Truman, there's so much I didn't know. If you can tell me a story that I didn't know, and you can tell it with aplomb, and it's fun, and panache, and all sorts of other SAT words,
right.
You own it. If you can, that's what I just love. When you can tell me a story that I don't know, and not that I know all the stories, but you read a lot and you stick around on the planet for a while and you don't die. And okay, so you read a lot of books. So tell me, you know a lot of stuff. So, but when there's something you don't know anything about, and you just get, I just get so lit up when I read a book that that whether it's whatever field it's in. And I'm learning something. Just tell me a story that I didn't know. That's really what I look for.
So can you say that you necessarily, that you read more nonfiction than fiction, or is there a balance between
them? I read much more nonfiction than fiction. I think that we're in a real drought in terms of quality fiction. And I just think so much of it is very precious, and everybody's trying to sound like they went to the Iowa Writers' Conference, and there's very little. I mean, the only authors I read, the only new authors I read are Michael Connelly,
right?
John Grisham. I think John Grisham's the most underrated author in history. People are like, well, he can't be any good. He's so popular.
Right.
And I'm like, what did you just say? Come here, let me slap the stupid out of you, because, you don't get to be, you don't sell 300 million books unless you really, really, I'm reading his new one, Camino Island. And it's not his best work. It looks like he had a contract to fulfill. So he phoned it in,
right.
But it's still. But there are still moments of his sense of humor and his sense of outrage, and so I love Grisham, I love Connolly, but a couple of others, but almost nobody, and the rest of the time, I don't know. I mean, I think Tom Wolfe was the last living author who will still be read. I assume there are people and that they read books 50 years from now. I think Tom Wolfe is the last one, and everything else is perishable. And if it's perishable, if I'm not going to care about it in 20 years, why do I want to know? Why do I want to spend time on it now? So that's why I don't read a lot of fiction.
No. Well, you're not feeling that there's, like, maybe because nonfiction, you could always find a topic they haven't read, but nonfiction doesn't sometimes also feel redundant or
no. Well, I mean, there are very few, I think very few books that are published are worth reading.
Okay.
But at the same time, the ones that are great. They'd be great in any era. I mean, this book on the Crusades will, it'll be popular. It's called The Crusades. And it'll be popular 20, 50 years from now. It's fantastic. And so when something's that good, I bow to greatness.
Right.
And nonfiction is a little easier in the sense that, you're telling a story about a person or an event or an idea, and if the writing is great, that's sort of a wonderful bonus. I mean, I've got Charles Murray's latest book, and he's such a great stylist. And in addition to being a true thought leader, as opposed to a faux thought, everybody's a thought. He's right. A real deal. So I love that stuff. Whereas, I just don't want to read. I don't want to read anything precious, and I don't want to read anything. I mean, this stuff is so boring. It's just, you just want to throw up. So, but that's just me. Others love it, and
right.
It's chocolate and vanilla.
Well, is that why you'd say that most books that are published these days are not worth reading, just because the subject matter isn't worth reading, or because the writing quality is not up to par?
Yeah, I mean, look, about 30 years ago, there's a store in Boston called Filene's Basement. And you'd go down there and you could find. And I went in one time, I found a sport jacket I really liked. It didn't fit exactly well. So I went over and I had this one guy, because I loved his taste. and I'd always look for him, and I showed him the jacket. It was an older European gentleman. I said, do you know a tailor who could take care of this, who could make this jacket right for me? And he looked at me and said, they're all dead. And, you know, I always think about that because it just seems as though, you know, the people who could pick out really outstanding work, they don't seem to exist because I'm not seeing it on the fiction side. And the people who are, you know, and I don't know. I mean, I think writers are too much influenced by the ephemeral, by social media and all, and by stuff that just doesn't matter. And everything seems so important because you're reading about it on your feed.
Right.
You know, I don't have a feed. I mean, the only feed I have is in the kitchen at night. And then I eat a lot. But, you know, we're just paying too much attention to stupid stuff and not enough attention to what really matters. And you don't have, you know, the whole technology era brings in a lot of short-sighted thinking. You're just focused on what's on your phone. I don't know how to write a good novel about the crap on my phone or your phone or anybody else's phone. You know, people are staring at their phones like, and they're just hypnotized by them. And that's just not going to be the, I mean, you know, 40 years ago they were saying people today are too much influenced by television, and it seems as though all the novels are written by people who grew up watching television instead of reading books. And, you know, I think it's even worse now. I think we're looking up to that era. And,
oh, wow.
and instead, you know, this is just not, there's no good classical music. I mean, there's no good music, you know, like a Beethoven. Where are the Beethovens? Where are the Mozarts? Where are the Beatles of today?
In film. They're writing scores for film.
We have the most amazing tools for creating, and nothing good is getting created. Thank you. I rest my case.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I don't know if that ties into the answer, then if I would flip the question to say, what is something you can't stand when either writers or the industry does, or you have a different answer for that?
Yeah, I have a different answer for that.
Okay.
I mean, today, on the nonfiction side, who gets deals with New York? People who are busy building up their social media, followers, the numbers of their followers, they're running around the country doing keynotes, and they're not really having fresh ideas. A perfect example, and they're just repeating the same trash from other books or good stuff from other books, and everybody's just stealing from everybody else. And it makes it, you know, one time I went to the library, I took out four business books. I'm a library rat.
Right.
And I took out four business books, and in three of them there was the same story about how United trashed a guy's guitar, and he took a video of it. The baggage crew took a guitar out of the case and started smashing it on the ground like they were rock stars.
Oh,
and
yeah. I know about that.
The guy on the plane taps the guy next to him and says, look out the window, that's so funny. The guy looks out the window, it's not so funny, it's his guitar. So
right.
He takes a video, and United doesn't apologize. I'm sorry, we can't reply. And, you know, and it goes viral. So this story appears in three of the four business books I took out of the library the same night.
Wow.
That's what makes me crazy.
Today, right.
Business books, most nonfiction, not the ones I write or the ones I read, are one chapter or two chapters of useful material and 12 chapters of Hamburger Helper. And, you know, who's going to, what that does is it cheapens the value. This is why people don't read books, because they know that it's not worth it. It's like there's a single's worth of material, but they have to buy the whole album to get the single. Nobody does that anymore. They just buy the single or the EP. Nobody's buying, you know, so you're forced to overbuy and to pay $25 for a book that's got $3 worth of valuable chapter. And to me, that makes me crazy, because that makes all books look bad. Thank you. I'm really on my soapbox.
you're your best today.
I'm always on my soapbox. It's just that nobody else listens. And you know, so anyway.
Well, I don't know if it's just because, you know, all these companies they have the business side of things to run. And sometimes when you've got a business, you know, you carry your quality products and you got to carry the rest of the fillers. Or if it's just really because they think that the fillers are the same level,
you know,
of quality as the quality stuff.
I'm starting my own publishing company. This sounds like it's silly, but you can look at nanosecondpublishing.com. And I'm starting it with Charles Michael Yim, who invented the breathometer. He's a big technology guy.
Oh.
And our first product is going to be a manual called The Art of the Pitch. It's going to teach people how to pitch businesses, because he's incredibly successful at it.
Right.
And it, you know, there's not a word of filler. I mean, it's short. It's about 60 pages. But
right.
Guess what? That's all you need. 60 pages from Charles Yim, and you will know how to pitch and get a deal and or get an investment. We're not larding it with 180 pages of caca just so that it looks like a full-size book. It's 60 pages. It's going to be called a manual and not a book because it's a manual on pitching.
Right.
And, so we'll see. We'll see.
Oh, I didn't know about that. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
Now you could finally publish, really publish all the stuff that you want to get out there.
Well, there are certain things that would fit that model and certain things that wouldn't, but
that's true.
It's but the fun thing is, you know, he came to me and said, look, you know, you're big on independent publishing. Do you have a model for disrupting traditional publishing? And I said, yes, I do. And so, you know, I've been working on a plan and I tried with a couple of other people. It didn't work out. And here we go.
All right. We get to keep tabs on this now. Yeah. Even though there's really so much more to talk about, but you did mention, and then we said we're going to speak about that, you're starting a new writing course. Oh, we didn't even mention that you're also a writing coach. I mean, you sort of mentioned it. You're a writing coach, you're a consultant. People could come to you and be educated and be guided, I should say. But you're starting a new writing course. So what's that all about?
Yes. Yeah, it comes down to the fact that most people who want to write books have a few concerns. One is they don't know which book to write, especially if they've been in business or in any field for a number of years, or even if they're just getting started. There's so many different books that the average intelligent person, successful person can write. Like, which one do I write? And then how do I write it? And then how do I organize it so that it's going to be successful and a moneymaker? And there's a dirty little secret, which is that best-selling books sometimes don't make a lot of money.
Right.
So you can be a bestseller and still not have the cash coming in. So the question is, how do you monetize the book that you have chosen to write and that you've written or had written for you? So it's all of those questions, and I call it the best-earning author system.
Okay.
It's 3.5 hours of material, and it's about to launch on Teachable. And so you just look for my name, Michael Levin, and the best earning author system. And you can find it there. And it teaches you not just how to write a book. There are a lot of decent places, a lot of good places where you can learn how to write a book. But you've got to know, which book should I write? How do I organize it so that it's going to be of maximum success to the reader and to my bottom line? And then how do I publish it, distribute it, and market it so that I monetize the book? What are all the different things that I could do to monetize a book that most people have never heard of? How do I get myself into the Wall Street Journal tomorrow? How do I become a bestseller in an hour? How do I buy public relations services for my book without getting ripped off? What exactly do I need? How do I measure success? And how do I distribute my book into airport bookstores? Most writers may or may not know one or two of these pieces, but I've been doing this long enough, and I've had over, as I said, 750 clients.
Right.
That I've either written for, edited, created, published their books. So I've just seen more books than most people. I've seen more of the industry than most people. And I came up through the legacy publishers, the Simon & Schuster's. I've published with almost all of the top New York houses. I know how that game is played. You want to understand how you get a deal with a major publisher? That's in the course as well. And then you'll find out, you know, can I get a deal? Will I qualify in their eyes or not? And then if I publish independently, what's the secret back door to the major houses that I can go through once I've had a certain level of success? So there's so much in the best earning author course that you just can't find anywhere else. And it's all, you know, 3.5 hours summing up, you know, more than 30 years of experience in the publishing industry.
Wow.
And, you know, it's a game. People say it's a game changer. It just changes the way they relate to the idea of writing, and they're able to take what they've been doing for all the years in their careers and take that body of knowledge and experience and monetize it, because, you know, a book is an opportunity not just to get ideas out there and to influence people and to teach and do all those good things, but when you know how, it's an opportunity to be paid not just for what you're doing for your time, but instead to be paid for what you know and what you've done so far in your career. And you take all that and you turn it into a book, and a certain kind of book in a certain way, and you blast it out there with you know, all these different things that are that I get into in the program, and you end up, you can, what's the real deliverable? Now you know how to write a book that can make you real money every step of the way, and you can have a heck of a lot of fun with every phase of it instead of struggling. It takes the struggle out, it takes the struggle and the starvation out of being a writer, and that's what the best earning author system is all about.
That sounds very good to me. Well, and also just to clarify, this is not just for nonfiction, it's for, it will help fiction writers as well.
It will help fiction writers understand publishing, but it's primarily for nonfiction. Primarily for nonfiction. I really have to be clear about that.
Because
otherwise, I don't want the novelists listening and then they go get it and they're like, he didn't say word one about novels. No, I really don't.
Right.
The aspects. So here's the difference, publicizing nonfiction is so much easier to publicize than fiction. And here's an example of why that's so. Nonfiction author goes on Oprah. Tell us about your book. Well, it's about the 7 ways to attract a mate. And if you look at the PowerPoint, number 1, number 2, number 3, and it's great. The audience is on their feet. They're applauding and they're looking fascinated.
Right.
Now we'll be right back with our next guest, the novelist. Novelist comes out, a round of applause. So tell me, what's your novel about? The novelist just sort of sits there, strokes his chin, and goes, that's a really good question.
Right.
And Oprah says, we'll be right back with another guest after, because, it's a million times harder to sell fiction. So I will say this, the course does not teach you how to structure a novel. I've taught that a million times at UCLA. That's not what this is about. But it will show you how to publish, distribute, and monetize your novel, because those are things that are applicable to any kind of book.
Right.
So if you are a novelist, we're going to have a separate conversation, and I'm going to take you through 3-act structure and scene structure as I would if you were my private writing a coach person or a client, or if we were in a classroom together at UCLA. But so I don't want to create any illusions. That's not in there. But then, okay, now it's done. What do I do? How do I publish it without getting ripped off? How do I distribute it so that people actually see it? And then most of all, how do I put money in my pocket as a result of being an author? And that's the thing that eludes most authors. And you take this course and you're going to know. You're going to know how. And how do I know this? I've been doing it for 30 years. This is what don't ask me anything else. I have no other marketable skills. And as my wife will tell you, I'm incompetent at everything else. But the reality is that I'm not incompetent. She just thinks I am. As I tell my sons, anything you do in a marriage well, you're going to have to do over and over again. But the reality is this is all I know, and I know it inside out and backwards. And this is my chance to share it with everybody who is interested and wants to be successful and well-paid as an author.
All right. That sounds really good.
Did I say it's on teachable.com?
Yes, you did. You can say it again. Okay. It's on teachable.com. And then we're going to wrap up now, but is there any last thing you want to throw out there to writers or readers or anyone else?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to say to your folks what I end up telling a client at least weekly, which is ignore the idea of critics. Today there are no critics. Nobody's going to criticize your book. Even if they do, they're a dumbbell. Who cares? The reality is that your book is going to help other people. It's going to be of service to other people. It's going to make a difference in other people's lives. It's going to transform the way they think, the way they live, the way they pray, the way they meet people, whatever it is, through whether it's a novel or nonfiction. So you must ignore the voices in your head that say, little me, who am I to do this? I have no right. I'm not Hemingway. You got to get over yourself. You got to get over all that stuff, because the thing is that, yes, maybe other people have written books in the subject area that you want to write about, but they're not you. They didn't grow up in your home. They didn't have your life experience. They don't have your knowledge base.
Right.
And while they may appeal to certain people, only you are going to be able to speak to the people who are your tribe, in Seth Godin's phrase. So, you have no right to deprive the world of your knowledge, your experience, and the quality of your writing. We need it, because otherwise you have a puzzle piece that the rest of us don't have. So how dare you hide it from us? Get it out into the open. Let us learn from it. And then you can always go back into a second edition and improve it later on. But get it out into the world and get it out as quickly as you can.
Wow, that's fabulous. I feel like I'm going to go right now. Thank you, yes. Michael, so much. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for being on our podcast. We really appreciate it.
Esther Leia, it's a delight to speak with you and to know you, and I adore you, and thank you so much for having me. This has been a great pleasure.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.